From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
There is apparently consensus developing at the UN Security Council over how to deal with the 11-month-long Saudi war on Yemen. This was the current council president, Venezuela's Ambassador Rafael Ramirez, at a press conference following a council session Thursday.
Yemen, there was a draft statement on Yemen proposed yesterday. Have you agreed on it, and what's the status on it?
Yes, it's a very good statement. Now it's in the public manner. You can find all the details. And it was a good example that the Security Council can agree some issues, important issues, for the current situation.
For its part, Saudi Arabia said it will not stop its military operations against Yemen and that the war will continue until the country's fugitive former president is returned to power. This was Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir.
It's a matter of time before the international coalition in Yemen succeeds in restoring the legitimate government of Yemen to Yemen in control of all of Yemen's territory. The support for the legitimate government will continue until the objectives are achieved or until an agreement is reached politically that achieves the objective.
As the Saudis continue to pound the country from the air, with, according to various media reports, targeting data supplied by the U.S., the humanitarian crisis facing millions of Yemenis continues to deepen. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
The UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reported that 13.6 million Yemeni civilians have been affected by the war. The report said every 4 out of 5 Yemeni people are in need of humanitarian assistance. The Geneva-based international body added that increased attacks by Saudi Arabia on civilian and economic infrastructure have deprived millions of Yemeni families from their livelihoods.
Meanwhile, the wrangling continues over who is and is not a terrorist among the militia groups fighting the Syrian government. That question was among the major issues that caused the suspension of peace talks earlier this month. This was British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond speaking with BBC's Andrew Marr this past Sunday.
There's about 150,000 moderate opposition fighters. I wouldn't call them all democratic, but moderate opposition fighters on the ground.
The last of the moderate opposition are holding out in Aleppo right now, and the Russians are pounding them. Are you calling on the Russians to stop right now?
Yes, we are. But just to be clear, that isn't where the last of the moderate opposition are. There are moderate opposition positions there. There are moderate opposition positions in the outskirts of Damascus. There are moderate opposition positions in the south of the country.
Dr. Boutena Shaban, political advisor to the president of Syria, took issue with the claim that Syria and its Russian allies were targeting moderate opposition.
You notice how many words people look for: rebels, insurgents, opposition, anyone who carries arms against civilians, against government, against institutions is a terrorist. Political opposition should be dealing with politics, should be an opposition against a government, but by political means, without using arms, without killing people, without beheading people. You remember the person who ate the heart of a Syrian soldier? That was from the Free Army, and the Free Army is considered to be moderate by some Western countries. Moderate opposition. Can't terrorism be moderate? Can't somebody who is beheading people and killing people and destroying and raping women and attacking minorities in a country, can those be considered moderate? Can those be considered opposition? I want to talk to you in a Western frame of mind. Can Britain or France or the US accept any opposition that carries arms, attacks schools, kills people? I mean, why do they apply terminology on us that does not apply anywhere in the world? You know, this is unacceptable, really.
A task force was set to meet Friday afternoon in Geneva to discuss a planned cessation of hostilities in Syria. Germany's foreign ministry said in a statement that the Russians and Americans will chair the meeting, which ministry spokesperson Martin Schaefer said could lead to agreement on a significant reduction in violence between all parties that participated in the Vienna talks. The ongoing violence between Israelis and Palestinians is showing no signs of relenting. That, according to the UN envoy Nikolai Mladenov Thursday, as he briefed the Security Council via video link from Jerusalem. At least 137 Palestinians and 20 Israelis have died during the spiral of violence that began as a dispute over holy sites to both Judaism and Islam. Jocelyn Sambira filed this report.
On January 31st, a Palestinian security officer traveling in an official vehicle opened fire at a checkpoint near Ramallah and injured three Israeli soldiers. Although the officer was acting independently, he stated, such incidents were especially dangerous as they corroded the relationship between the two security forces. Mr. Mladenov also shared with council members details of an assault by Palestinian youths that took place early on Thursday.
Just a couple of hours before this session, in a supermarket in the West Bank, two Israelis were stabbed, one of whom later succumbed to his wounds. The two 14-year-old Palestinian attackers were shot by an armed civilian. Our thoughts go out to the families of these latest victims.
Security means alone cannot address these violent events, the special envoy said, calling on political leaders on both sides to stand up to incitement and the radicals within their own constituencies. Meanwhile, he spoke out against the administrative detention of the Palestinian journalist Mohammed Al-Kik, who has been on a hunger strike for 85 days. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
With the involvement, whether direct or by proxy, of the U.S. military in wars raging across the Middle East and the continent of Africa, and with an escalation of saber-rattling across the globe from the Baltics to the South China Sea, U.S. President Barack Obama is asking Congress for more than $500 billion for a Pentagon budget that promises never-ending war for the foreseeable future. Commentator and analyst Danny Haifong, in a recent article at blackagendareport.com, wrote that the $582 billion military budget for 2017 is another indicator of the desperation of U.S. imperialism. We spoke with him via Skype this past weekend.
So the article details the Obama administration's request for $582 billion, roughly around the same amount as last year, with a few increases in some key objective policy initiatives, like the increase in funds for the military surrounding of Russia in Eastern Europe, through Eastern Europe, as well as the continuation of the farcical so-called war against ISIS, which is about to expand into Libya, a country that the Obama administration destroyed in 2011 through the same proxy forces that have gained power in what was once a prosperous and socialist nation.
And an 8.5 month daily carpet bombing campaign too, of course.
Exactly, the daily bombing campaign that occurred in March 2011, and continued for almost a year, killing tens of thousands of Libyans to the point where the city that Gaddafi is from, Sirte, which was a majority black Libyan city, is now controlled by the so-called ISIS forces, right, that the U.S. is purportedly fighting a war against.
What's left of it, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
What's left of it, exactly. So the budget request of $582 billion basically goes over the war plans of the United States for the foreseeable future. We know that the DPRK has recently made a huge industrial achievement through its launching of a satellite just recently this month, and that has provided the impetus for the United States to renew and re-energize its war against the DPRK, and discussions in the South are happening to basically further militarize what is already a deeply militarized state in South Korea.
And China is pointing out that, the U.S. is essentially talking about deploying more hardware. I mean, they have
you know, they occupy Japan and South Korea still, the Philippines and other places around it, and the engagement that they've been, the game they've been playing with China, the South China Sea. But they're talking about now moving more military assets into that area, which, of course, can just as easily reach China as they can North Korea. And the Chinese are very concerned about it. And looking at a map, you now have an encirclement of Russia and China from the Baltics mm-hmm. all the way to the Korean Peninsula.
Exactly, and the Pentagon is not shy about detailing and basically declaring that all of its all of its war maneuvers are directed at China and Russia. China and Russia are what the Pentagon quoted as to be their most stressing competitors.
Right.
In a large way, that's because China's socialist economy has become the most dominant and powerful economy in the world. And Russia's, rise militarily as well as politically has threatened to upend a lot of what U.S. imperialism wants to do in the region. It's undermined its dominance in Europe. It's undermined its dominance in the Middle East through Russia's aid to Syria, as well as its unrelenting stance that no longer will 2011 and pre-2011 policies be allowed to exist, the policy of destabilization, in the same manner. So really what the article details is the Pentagon's budget requests, which, you know, by all stretches of the true analysis of the presidential elections right now is going to be carried forward by whoever is elected. And you know, I make the point in the article that that's because imperialism and war in particular, as a form of imperialism, is absolutely necessary for the larger world capitalist economy to continue to be dominated by the United States. As as we know here in the United States, the capitalist economy is in pretty deep crisis. People are struggling, and the low oil prices, the huge dip in oil prices, really signal that there is a deep decline in the capitalist economy. And in order to accumulate and to continue to stretch itself, the imperialist system has to, with the United States at its head, wage endless war all over the planet. So
there's all kinds of signs of this huge crisis too. I mean, first, just politically speaking, you have a phalanx of presidential candidates, from Bernie Sanders to Mark Rubio or Bozo the Clown or whoever, and that all agree that the condition of the people here economically in the United States is, most kindly put, under stress, many, catastrophic. The objectively speaking, catastrophic is pretty close, and most of the people themselves know that their situation is very tenuous. So this military budget comes out to about $1,800 for each man, woman, and child in the United States, or in an average household of three people. Okay, you're talking about $5,400 a year for this military, which, of course, could solve a lot of people's, economic problems at home. And then in Europe, where you're looking at, still the implosion of the European economy, mass unemployment, austerity, all of that, even though the governments in Germany and maybe to a lesser degree in France, certainly in the UK and elsewhere, are on board with the U.S. policy toward Russia and militarizing generally, the people have been very actively opposing a lot of that. And as the economy teeters over there, the support for governments that are, focusing on militarization instead of solving economic problems, it can only grow. So Russia is competing with the United States in a Europe that is fractured between its government and its people, essentially.
Right. Yes. And, I think in the U.S. context, that brings up a especially interesting point, given that in the United States, There is no social welfare system that even you know, that even can be compared to that of Europe. You know, there are different standards of living that I think, you know, workers in the United States are just not used to. Workers in the United States are not used to, you know, universal health care. They're not used to, you know, Social Security that can actually, that people can actually live off of.
Right.
They're
free education.
Exactly. They're not used to free education. And so in Europe, you know, the struggle against austerity, I think, is much further along and much stronger. Here in the United States, what's interesting is that, you know, the Bernie Sanders campaign has emerged. And just the 2016 elections, although the discussion around U.S. imperialism and U.S. warfare, endless warfare, is still pretty negligible, I think that, you know,
with the exception of Trump, by the way,
opportunistically
acknowledges by taking his position, because he jumps in the polls when he does it, that the sentiment of the American people actually lies outside of the narrow band that's being discussed by the other candidates.
Exactly. And I think the sentiment among, you know, among American people, especially workers, is anti-war. But on the one hand, there's a deep misunderstanding about what war is under the conditions of U.S. imperialism. Right. A lot of people are still okay with the United States doing what it does around the world, or at least okay with not acknowledging it, without the understanding that, you know, the bombs and the proxy wars and the, you know, campaigns of destabilization of the United States wages abroad has a direct impact and a direct relationship to the oppression that occurs here in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting, especially given this whole Beyonce fiasco during the Super Bowl performance, where a lot of people got excited, even some, you know, some leftists that I run with got excited. It'll be interesting to see whether those same people will now try to interject the true legacy and the true history of the Black Panther Party in order to really address questions like what the Pentagon is going to put forward in 2017, which is really a bigger and badder continuation of what it's been doing for, you know, decades.
You've seen this appropriation of the symbols of, you know, the progressive movement, the liberation movement, the anti-imperialist movement. Bernie Sanders calling himself a socialist, for example. And, you know, on the one hand, I mean, there's contradictions there. On the one hand, making it okay to talk about socialism in the public discourse. And on the other hand, of course, calling himself a socialist while saying he does not approve of the appropriation of the means of production by the workers, which is essentially socialism. That and class consciousness and class self-direction and anti-imperialism because of solidarity with the working class of other countries, internationalism. You see the appropriation of these symbols on the one hand, but on the other hand, materially, that $582 billion is being extracted from the American population and applied to the construction, deployment, placement of these weapons.
Exactly. In the United States, you know, the productive capacity of United States capitalism at this moment is in such a crisis, and it's developed to the point where military production is really the only production that occurs in the United States. Right. The United States is wholly dominated by finance capital,
right.
And finance capital is even more volatile, and it heightens the contradictions and antagonisms of capitalism like no other stage beforehand. And so what we're seeing now, I think, with the Bernie Sanders campaign and, you know, how it is sort of changing the discourse of the American population, I think the Bernie Sanders campaign still is very useful for U.S. imperialism. I still think that although there are positives that can be seen from the campaign in terms of the conversation that has occurred on socialism, and I think just in terms of the overall consciousness in the last 8 years, I think Bruce Dixon made a great point in Black Agenda Report. But the conversation that's happening around the elections this year is by far a more positive conversation than what was happening in 2012 and 2008, where we really couldn't bring up even the economic questions. But the economic questions of free education, of healthcare, of debt, of you know, how costly everything is in the United States, how most people in the United States don't have $1,000 to their name, that those conversations are really nothing and don't really equate to much when trillions of dollars of our surplus value is going to the, you know, warfare state abroad. And it's really nothing when, you know, if we're going to really build a powerful working class movement in this country, we're going to need the support and the solidarity of people all over the world. I actually was having an argument with a friend recently about socialism. And, you know, she was making the argument that it's impossible, you know, that it's pretty impossible right now, given the consciousness of people, to think about socialism. And how are people going to change after, let's say, a revolution occurs? And I'm like, well, we're going to have to really learn from people all over the world. We're going to have to really, you know, when it comes to questions of the environment, we're going to have Cuban advisors in the United States teaching us how to produce in a way that is sustainable, because they happen to be the most sustainable country in the world. Right. We're going to have to learn from, you know, from various advisors of countries all over the world on how to be peaceful and how to relate to other people. There are things that are going to have to change, and we can't do that alone. And I think that, you know, when we're talking about Bernie Sanders, the question of imperialism has to be really high on our agenda, because a vote for him is still a vote for war. It's still a vote for the continuation of the destruction and the chaos and ultimately the extraction of our labor for the purposes of destroying other people's lives. And we have to really be attuned to that and conscious of it.
You know, I spoke the other day with someone whose name, of course, as a contributor to Black Agenda Report, you'll recognize, Professor Anthony Montero.
Mm-hmm.
One of the points that we kicked around was, if you look at the phenomenon of Barack Obama back in 2008 at SEC, you know, you had the image of America's first Black president. Now, you know, without parsing the fact that he doesn't come from the typical African-American background. His family, his father wasn't here for 10 generations, you know, descended from slaveholder, lived through Jim Crow and all of that, but rather he's first-generation African, which actually militates even more in a way. What we got from America's first Black president was AFRICOM and the installation of U.S. military command and control among 35 national militaries on the African continent. In other words, a reacquisition directly under military control of the continent of Africa by Western imperialism. What can we expect from a socialist, quote-unquote, like Bernie Sanders?
Well, more of the same. And actually, just listening to the debates that have occurred in the Democratic Party, we can easily conclude that Sanders is pretty much in line with the way that the Obama administration has ideologically constructed what war is. War, for the Obama administration only means that U.S. troops are on the ground, right, in a very vague and abstract conception of war.
And I mean, they had they actually litigated when the group of congressional members brought a lawsuit seeking to impose the War Powers Act on his bombing of Libya. That was 2 months old at that point and continued for another 6. They litigated whether or not, in fact, in the reply papers, the Obama administration said our bombing of Libya does not constitute hostilities as set forth under the War Powers Act because we haven't suffered any losses.
Exactly. So Bernie Sanders has, you know, he has continued that trend in his own rhetoric by attaching himself to the anti-war sentiments of Americans broadly, in that he advocates for no troop presences, for no combat troops, for no invasions, no repeats of Iraq. And he will continually mention how he voted against Iraq without mentioning how he voted for Afghanistan. And, you know, that has been the Obama administration's ideological weapon to align the masses with its war agenda. AFRICOM is the perfect example, given that, you know, part of the reason why Libya was such a target was that it was one of the few countries on the continent that wholly rejected AFRICOM.
And yeah, it kicked out the last U.S. military base back in 1970. It was one of the first things Gaddafi did was kick the U.S. off the African continent.
Exactly. And, you know, many people remember that Ronald Reagan also tried to lay waste to Libya and destabilize its government in the 80s for the very same purpose that the Obama administration was targeting Libya. Which was not only to get a hold of its oil assets and its huge resource reserves, but also to turn Libya back into a geostrategic military center that, you know, would fortify and continue to expand U.S. imperialism's presence on the continent. Because not many people know that prior to World War II, Africa was not really in U.S. imperialism's orbit. It wasn't until after World War II that U.S. imperialism really turned its attention to the continent in order to gain a hold of what Europe lost. And I think that, you know, the expansion of AFRICOM under Obama, which would be continued by Bernie Sanders — he hasn't made any position statement on Africa or much of anything else — it is really all about the continuation of the stranglehold of the U.S. military over the continent and towards the objective of keeping China out of Africa and keeping any emerging competitors, emerging alternative political and economic systems from being able to thrive and develop in Africa. And, you know, one of the reasons why Libya was such a target was because the Gaddafi leadership in the Jamahiriya was looking to expand a more pan-African and independent mode of economic and political development on the continent. So when it comes to Bernie Sanders, you know, he is really trying to tug at the heartstrings, rightfully so, of Americans who don't want to go to war. Literally, they don't want to. They don't want to be sent into a war zone around the world. But at the same time, U.S. imperialism is already creating war zones and murdering people of the world. And, you know, I think we have to nuance and develop our understanding of what war is. And it's much more than what imperialism and what the corporate media, you know, will have us believe.
Yeah, I mean, if you have the military spending $500 billion a year, something is going on, obviously. Your article concludes, still, war remains largely outside of the discourse and activity of activists, organizations, and movement politics in the United States. This presents a deep challenge to the struggle for social transformation within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It says, solidarity and internationalism must be part of the broad strategy against the exploitation of the U.S. power structure. Without the peoples of the world on our side and vice versa, the new world that's in birth will be confined to infancy. So it lays out what the challenge is. How do we meet it?
We meet it by continuing to interject and be critical about developments that are happening all over the world. But also, I think I wrote in a piece before that on Ta-Nehisi Coates that we really have to start practicing self-criticism and criticism in this movement. I think now is the time. Now is the time where there is a sweeping raising of social consciousness and political consciousness in this country. I think that the conversation around police brutality, the conversation on racism and white supremacy in this country, has really developed in a very rapid and fast way. You know, I think in the work that we are doing, whatever that may be, we have to bring up the question of war, because, you know, the next economic crisis is going to create conditions where more and more people will be asking questions. And so we are going to have to insert war. We're going to have to insert, you know, all the numerous policy ventures and militaristic agendas of the imperial state. We're going to insert those into the conversation.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.